Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Doomer Optimism Podcast. Ashley here with Brian and John Robb. I'm going to let Brian take it away first, because Brian had the idea to coordinate this conversation. So he works pretty regularly with John and is familiar with Doomer Optimism. So I want Brian to talk to us briefly about what his idea is for this conversation. Then I'll have John introduce himself, and then we'll jump into it. But Brian, can you start by just introducing yourself, giving a short bio, and then what you have in mind for today?
Hi, folks. I'm a failed two-time chicken farmer and former nomadic goat herd. I've built two greenhouses. I've attempted to train oxen and failed. And I've also killed countless numbers of things in my gardens over the years. I also run a marketing consulting company for the last 10 years. So I fit into that category of tech worker who thinks the best thing in the world is to make so much money you can afford to buy a farm. Mm. And I had the idea for this conversation because there's a fundamental question of what is the way forward? Is it possible to revert back to simpler energy means like being, sheep. I'm past my goat phase, maybe. Don't ask my wife that question. I think sheep farm is the farm for me. And we also have bees, of course, like everyone else does. Or can we revert back? Or is the only way forward to go and build something new, build different ways of using energy? And John and Ashley agree on a substantial amount of what the reality path works for everybody and creates the kind of world we all want to live in, where the average person has access to peace and security, good food, loving family relations, like all the good stuff we want. The vision of the good life is substantially similar, but where does energy fit into that? Forward or to a lower energy level? That's, I think, the most interesting question between the two of you.
Okay, great. And then I'll have John introduce himself, but I just want to briefly say, like, this is definitely a topic in the Doomer Optimism sphere in general. Like, how do we move forward with energy? A lot of us, are agnostic about nuclear, but just like practically, how do we move forward? So that would be that. I'm very excited for this because a lot of us are just kind of fumbling around in the dark with that question. So John, I'll have you go briefly introduce yourself and then we can jump into it.
Yeah. I write the Global Guerrillas Report, and it's the intersection of technology, warfare, and politics. And I've been writing about the disruption of globalization for probably 20 years now, and new methods of making decisions as a society, and how that impacts warfare and how that impacts how we go forward. And I cover a lot of the topics that are, you know, the areas that are driving deglobalization and disruption and kind of the difficulties we're going to face in the future.
Nice. Okay. So I think it might just be useful to define this term just before we even get started. Can you tell everybody your idea about this the network swarm? What is the network swarm? what does it do? Yeah. And let's just start with that as sort of a basis for the conversation, too, because I think it's a really useful concept.
Yeah, I started working on the concept back 2003 with the Iraq War. And, I was special ops, tier one counterterrorism guy with SEAL Team 6 and Delta and that kind of thing. And also tech entrepreneur. And I did a lot of the early work on social networking back in 2001. So when I took a look at the Iraq War, I saw that it wasn't operating along standard lines. It wasn't this like big pyramid of an insurgency with 70 different groups, and it was giving the counterinsurgents fits, on how to deal with it. They go up one or two levels in the organization, and that little organization that they were targeting fizzled away, and there were 69 others, and that one they just took out was replaced. So, you know, what I saw was that there was methods of communication between these various participants in the insurgency that weren't understood, and how they were able to coordinate their action in a way that could give military superpower fits. And then I tracked that, and that seemed to be pretty popular with all the NSA, DOD, JCS crowd. Even guerrillas like my stuff, which is kind of scary. And cool at the same time. I tracked it into protest movements, and that, you know, the same kind of dynamic worked in the Arab Spring across North Africa. and the Middle East, and then into U.S. politics, first with Occupy and Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street and Tea Party, and then into the U.S. general election with the election of Trump, which was really an open source insurgency where there were a lot of participants and they had certain dynamic that explained a lot of what was going on in that election. And the opposition to Trump was operating along similar lines, and it has since grown very, very large. And I'm calling that the swarm, which kind of reflects some of the dynamics by which it operates kind of the feeling you get when you interact with it. We saw it most recently, and this is kind of like the thing that was really surprising to me is that I knew that these networked organizations were getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I didn't expect it to reach a global level like it did recently with the invasion of Ukraine. And kind of a way to kind of everyone to see it in action is that when Russia invaded Ukraine, there was a government response and there was, you know, obvious outrage, and we were going to supply some weapons to Ukraine to defend themselves and, you know, put in very targeted sanctions to kind of force Russia to change. But what happened was that there was a network response where this swarm developed across all of the West, around the world, that essentially disconnected Russia overnight in a few short weeks, where all these companies started pulling out. All these measures, you know, in various levels of different governments were being taken to target Russian citizens and Russian oligarchs and the like, disconnecting them. So basically making an embargo on Russia, you know, escalating the war. And then they reframed the war from, you know, a war against, you know, a regional war that, you know, where a superpower had overstepped and they were going to try to force them back into the fold, into this war against evil, war against anti-democracy. I mean, it was this very clear moral framework, good versus evil. And the swarm wouldn't let anyone else reframe it, or wouldn't let anyone to work on any kind of off-ramp, which is important given that Russia is a nuclear power. And that's the swarm. that's you know, kind of an overview of kind of the development of my thinking on this. And I've been writing along about it all the way up to the point we're at right now. We're on the kind of edge of nuclear war, which is apparent to me back in March when I started writing about it. Now everyone's talking about it. So it's a kind of an inevitable dynamic at work.
Brian, do you want to jump in?
One of the fun things about being in John's sphere is you hear what the future looks like 6 months to 6 years in advance. And it's very confusing because people think you're crazy. And then I was explaining to my brother John's take on nuclear war and the decision-making of the swarm. And my brother's in politics, works for the government. And he was saying, he was thinking that I'm crazy as I'm talking about how nuclear war is likely. And I explained John's basic concept that the swarm does not have a sense of mortality. Before now, and my brother's thinking about every near nuclear conflict in the past. My brother's thinking, and to summarize, the adults in the room are not going to let this get that bad. Because
right.
They never have. And John's point is, there are no adults in the room. And I gave the example of at one point, the swarm was doing something. I don't even recall what this was now, John, you said, where Biden said something even more extreme. Because the only way to even pretend you're in charge of the swarm is to get in front of it. Which reminds me of canoeing down rivers, where on a river, as long as you stay slightly faster than the river, you're in control. But if you start being at the speed of the water will have its way with you. And there's rocks over there and there's an alligator over there and you're doomed. Mm-hmm. Slightly faster. And it gives us the illusion that people are in charge here. This is an illusion. Elon is not in charge. Putin's not in charge. Biden's not in charge. There's not people in mortality. There's not even the Americans that are in charge. There's not even the United States. No one is in charge. But we act as if it was because they always have been. And so we're making decisions. We are making decisions. But it's not us and it's not making in the way that we think of it. Which brings us to some of these questions around energy and food. And I have two beehives, but you can't eat enough honey to survive. And we have these ideas of like, oh, let's go raise some chickens. That's fantastic. Okay, and how many chickens do you need to actually live? And so I'm curious to take the conversation in that direction of food supply at the most basic level of doomer optimism. Let's not starve. And the way John would look at the let's not starve question and the way Ashley would is quite different.
Yeah.
I'm curious to hear, like, to dive into a little bit more of that.
Okay, wait, just briefly, I want to just clarify something on the network swarm before we go there. A lot of us are like almost like Marxist historical materialists, in that we're like, okay, we have energy, we have this, like, you know, sort of unstable globalized system. And then, you know, there's this process of deglobalization happening, of energy and resource crunches that seem to be happening. But what you're describing about the swarm, like, to get nerdy and sociological about it, it's like Weberian in the sense that ideas are interacting with material reality to change the trajectory of, like, the material world. And right. This is actually pretty crazy. And I want to dive into it just a little bit, Brian, before we get into, like, an optimism perspective, because just trying to wrap your head around this, I think a lot of us have the sense that it's happening, but I don't know of anyone who describes it as well as you do, John. And, like, basically it's like mimetic warfare. And sometimes it is to the detriment of people's material interests. Right. Going along with the swarm. So I don't know if maybe it makes sense to think a little bit about what's going on, and maybe this will get us in that direction, Brian, like, think a little bit what's going on in Europe with heat this upcoming winter, as a way of, like, describing how the swarm might even be doing things that are against their own interest. I think Europe is doing quite a few things that are against their own interest because of this mimetic swarm, but I'd like to hear your take on that.
Who is they? You said against their own interest. Who is they?
I would say, like, just the European people. I mean, like, just
which people, though? Because some people are really happy about what's going on.
Right. So, yeah, let's clarify that.
Well, I think it's because they haven't been through deprivation they don't sense what is going on in this new abstract space, this online space, where they spend so much time connects to their real world experience. And you know, it's being driven in large part because we've been reprogrammed. Our minds are being rewired through our interaction with the network. You know, we don't think rationally in the classical sense, that we read something, we think about it, we fit it in with our experiences, you talk to other people, we discuss in long form. And then come up with some kind of conclusion or opinion that yields some decision. We pattern match now. We can't handle the information flow. You know, it's just too much. And what we do as a coping mechanism, and it's reflected in the way our brains process this information, is we pick things out of context that fit patterns that we are co-curating with millions of other people. And these patterns, unfortunately, tend to be very aggressive patterns. They're more like anti this, because it's harder to actually agree on doing things together. If you ask people what justice means, they'll have a million different answers. Each person will have their own, but ask them what they're against, it's very much easier to get millions of people to agree. And these patterns describe what you're fighting. And it also makes it harder for you to change the minds of people who are connected to these patterns. They've already, you know, they've been trained to like, you know, tweets and posts that find bits of information and fit it into the pattern. You know, their minds have been socially kind of reinforced to think like the pattern. And, you know, once that pattern is formed, you can't disagree with it. I mean, any disagreement that may upset the pattern becomes like, I'm not going to give up this whole thing. My whole coping mechanism for interacting with this information flow, just because of this one piece of information. So, you know, I'll either throw it out, or I ignore it, or it doesn't exist. And you see that a lot in terms of the ramifications of you know, what this policy could do in terms of nuclear war. I mean, nuclear war won't happen. We're just beyond that. You know, Putin would never make that decision. No one would make that decision. If they did, they would be, you know, Putin would be and the world, and that's not possible. We'd respond too aggressively. It's a reflection of, you know, how we've been changed, and that's very McLuhan-esque. You know, McLuhan would say that we've been rewired. He was just early in his analysis, and that it's reflected in how we make decisions. Mm-hmm. I think long term, the optimistic piece of this is that we're coming up with a new decision making system for society as a whole. And this is out of Ronfeld stuff, the Timmins framework, which is the tribes, institutions, markets, and networks. He didn't really have any example of network decision-making systems at a global level or even at a national level, but now we're seeing the emergence of one. And just like the earlier ones, like markets and bureaucracies and things like that, it's going to take decades, hundreds of years to hash out how we turn those into useful decision-making systems. Bureaucracy. We figured out how to tame a government bureaucracy by using a market mechanism to select the leadership of that bureaucracy. So that combo, you know, worked to mitigate the excesses of a bureaucracy run amok. Because a bureaucracy is just, you know, as efficient at killing a million people as it is as mobilizing resources to build roads and infrastructure. So it's surviving until that point is going to be the tough part. So, that's my focus. Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's my story.
Yeah, go ahead, Brian.
Back when Bush the second was in charge, I was anti-war and I lived near Seattle. And so I was cool. And then Obama was in charge and I was anti-war. And then I was racist. And
yes.
Then Trump was in power and I was anti-war. And I think I was cool. I was sexist because Hillary was pro-war. Right. And now Biden's in power and I'm still anti-war. And now I don't even know. I've lost track.
Well, I just think of this concept of the Trump derangement syndrome, where even if Trump and this, there's like X derangement syndrome all over the place. Like even if somebody says something you agree with, you can't agree with it because the X person said it. And I understand John's making such a good point. Like, I almost think we're like going back to, things like this. Maybe this sounds silly, but like if you see that somebody has a Ukraine flag next to their Twitter handle and you're a Putin is evil person, you're going to trust that source no matter what they're saying. It's just like an in-group signal, almost to the point of like we're going to like almost character-based language where we understand a little tiny emoji as a symbol, as like an in-group belonging symbol, and then it determines how you
even
the information that's coming from that person.
Exactly. There's a tribal element, and tribalism typically is formed by, you have a in-group narrative that says, okay, here's why we're better together. And here's how we'll be better in the future because we're together. But we reversed it and we said, okay, here's what we're against. And you have to signal that you're in the tribe. So that comes down to a very, very root level in terms of how the problems with what that we're facing now is that it used to be that, you assume that the other person, if they presented information that had just a minimal amount of kind of support for it, that it was correct, right? That the, institutional support is generally correct information, well-sourced, it's generally correct information. But would add the tribal dynamic into it is the source of information coming from a person that is not in your tribe or is in an opposing tribe makes that information immediately suspect, because now that person is supplying facts that may be used to kill you or hurt you, right? And in tribalism, if you're not in the tribe, you're not even human. You're the opposition tribe is subhuman. They don't get any empathy, they don't get any trust. And so look at that from a societal level. If we can't talk to each other in a way that allows us to agree on basic facts, right, everything up above that in the stack is broken. There's no discussion to be had. It's because they said this, they're presenting this bit of information. Well, obviously that information is not trustworthy and you can't get beyond that.
We're doing
it makes a very dysfunctional system.
We're doing something illegal right now, which is that Ashley, you talked about your background and you used the word Marxist. And a couple summers ago, people who use the same language were beating up people in my town, putting blood on the streets.
Yep.
They also call themselves Marxists. Therefore, anyone else who uses similar language to what I've encountered in the past, I should immediately transfer everything bad, everything I'm anti, onto anyone else who uses the same language and never talk to them.
Yep. And the labels, right? I know, and the labels are so silly a lot of times too. Like, you know, just calling somebody like, I mean, right-wing people will call people just commies as if that's like really a legible characteristic at this point in history. Like a lot of it is, a lot of ideologies are very fluid at this moment, but you do have this team sports. I have one other question before I want to turn to energy, but I have one other question for John, and I wonder how this resonates with you. I don't know if you're familiar with one of my favorite authors is named Morris Berman. He wrote a series of books about just American history and culture. And one of his, he wrote like Dark Ages America and Why America Failed. And one of his theses about American like history and culture is that America's identity, he calls it a negative identity. So meaning we define ourselves by what we are not. So we define ourselves by our enemies, and through various, we have to like construct various enemies throughout history to sort of like, you know, we're not Iran, we're not Russia, you know, we're not the Taliban. And that leads to a kind of, I think, like team sports that basically only allows you to have any identity at all when you're in a conflict and deciding what you're not. But it doesn't leave a lot of room for the optimism side, because it's just sort of like, you know, we're only garnering meaning as a people in conflict, as like, you know, good versus evil. But what does good actually entail is a separate question, right, from what if we are not. Does that resonate with you?
Oh, I think it's very insightful, and it's, you know, it fits right in. It's one of the reasons why we're so prone to building these anti-frameworks and why they're so popular online, you know, anti-everything. You know, you can almost, the list is almost endless. It also goes back to what Tom Wolfe said about fascism in America. He goes, you know, fascism is always about to fall in America, but it always falls on Europe. It never gets any traction here because there's no singular identity in the United States. It's 1,000 different identities. I mean, you know, at least on the right. And so it's in Europe, there's this cultural heritage for each country. It's a silo. And then they reassert themselves. We don't have that here. It does make it hard to get anything done, though, right? Because you can't be for anything.
What's the positive vision, right?
Yeah, and it comes down to when you wipe out all of the sources of kind of traditional meaning, and everyone's coming up with their own sources, you know, of value formation and what they consider good and bad. It becomes very squishy. It's something we're going to have to work out. I don't have a definitive solution for it, but I do think that we'll find a lot more meaning at the periphery than we will at the center. Mm-hmm. And what networks allow us to do is to kind of cobble together things that we agree on at, you know, en masse, and mobilize resources very, very quickly, mobilize people very quickly. We just have to find a way to actually turn it into something that's positive. By limiting, you know, what is possible and how fast it can happen. What I don't want to see is that these anti-frameworks, the swarm actually defines this, you know, very, very tall value stack and, you know, a maximalist value stack, and then have it written into the infrastructure.
Right.
Used to train the AIs that moderate our discussions and mitigate our interactions and lock us into this very orthodox, very narrow way of you know, living in society. And I call that the long night, this kind of general lockdown where all innovation, anything that's outside of, like, you want to go to space? Well, we have to solve problems here first. Leave that for later. right? You're not allowed to talk about that. Or any kind of like, oh, you think this is bad? No, we don't think it's bad. You're censored off. Mm. It's like stale, stagnant, against human nature. It's kind of the same kind of argument we used against the Russians a long time ago. Is that you can't solve everything in a bureaucracy. You have to have a lot more moving parts, a lot more diversity in how you approach problems. But this one would be locked into infrastructure at the very root level and now not allow us anywhere, both in the US and anyone connected to our system, to ever get beyond it.
Is the idea basically like we have to put our heads down and solve this massive high level scale problem before we can even think about allowing you to do other like decentralized solutions?
It's worse. It's a moral version of that. It's good people know that we have to solve this problem first, that you are immoral for considering other problems. Like if you don't have a strong opinion about Ukraine right now,
right,
you are immoral. And it's not even voicing about some war crimes in Donbass or anything. It's if you think anything other, you are a bad person, and that means we were not going to listen to you. Mm. Only people who are moral are the people we should listen to. If you disagree with the consensus, you are therefore immoral, therefore we should not listen to you. But apply that from whatever makes sense to you. Like let's say some folks listening might say, well, Ukraine versus Russia is really obvious, so that actually makes sense for there. Fine. Take it to raised gardens or raised beds in subdivisions in the front yard. Someone feels just as strongly about that as you feel about Ukraine and how much you know what you know is right. Only immoral people would even consider having raised beds and destroying our property value in those front yards. Mm.
Okay, so I want to ask John a little bit about energy in Europe this upcoming winter. I want to get your take on that landscape. What you think, describe what you think is happening. I have a very general sense, but like being a localist, I'm like, I really just can't wrap my head around what's going on with a lot of these like international conflicts and material like resource issues. And also I don't trust sources. I'm sure I'm normal in that sense. Like I don't trust the information I'm getting. So give us your take on what's going on with this energy crunch that's upcoming in Europe that I'm hearing about.
Yeah, I mean, I've been working on a bunch of frameworks that kind of play into this. One is this idea of a permacrisis. You know, as the nation state system becomes less and less able to handle the complex problems of globalization, their only response is to deal with every problem as a crisis they have to have more and more authoritarian powers in order to confront. And we're like, one crisis is now running into the next, start with 9/11 and then on, financial crisis, you know, on and on and on. And that we are in the process of deglobalizing. Okay. And way back to my Brave New War, which was my book back in 2007, it was like the end of globalization was the byline. And because of, you know, ongoing disruptions from a myriad of actors, that they would just rip this global system down. And we're in that phase right now. Just being driven by this, the U.S. response to the Russian invasion was this war on anti-democracy, you know, as framed by Biden. And now, you know, that war is expanding from a war with Russia to now a war with China to a war with Saudi Arabia and on and on and on. Any country that doesn't really toe the line on our policy now is now considered an enemy. We even have domestic enemies. And, you know, the MAGA group is now, you know, domestic insurgency, according to the government. And the result is that the global system that we knew that, you know, allows us to, you know, borrow, you know, supports our debt load because it generates huge amounts of capital and that's almost free to borrow, you know, at 1% or less rates and less than inflation, actually, and also drives our growth as a whole, is now breaking down. And in particular, Russia, and we're seeing this with the energy. I mean, Russia is great for food and energy. and core inputs like fertilizer and the like. And so is Ukraine, and that's in turmoil. So when you take out what the number two or three energy producer in the world, and you know, those core commodities are taken off the table and sold at fire sales on the side, it causes waves of disruption that we're not ready to accommodate. And we're not even willing to even look at fully mitigating because of, you know, and restrictions on the our thinking placed on us by the environmental crisis. Right. And so, you know, or the legacy of environmentalism, meaning that we're not looking at nuclear power, and even accelerated nuclear power still takes, you know, 5-10 years to build out a plant.
Right.
So we're not, it doesn't replace all the home heating that is needed. So people are trying to do this on the, you know, kind of mitigate this, the impact of this energy crisis on their own, for their own needs. Like you see that everyone trying to buy pellet stoves in Europe or, you know, ceramic stoves to kind of burn, you know, burn the wood that they need to keep warm this winter. Net result will be like forests inside of Europe will start going away.
Which is like, you know, when you think about it, like this does seem to me a little bit like swarm behavior. And I guess just to like describe my own environmental approach, I think that there are basically two strands of environmentalism. The main one is like 99% of people who call themselves environmentalists are people who are like, you know, anti-nuclear, but also just like pro covering everything with solar panels and pro, you know, putting electrifying everything or having renewable energy on everything. But they don't think a lot about there are different forms of energy that besides electricity that people use. There is this kind of swarm behavior, I think, especially with the nuclear thing going on, where it's like, you know, we're good environmentalists, we're good. Nuclear's evil. And at the same time where they're like having, I shouldn't laugh, but like having limited access to heating fuel, they're also shutting down other forms of energy that could help mitigate that. But I almost feel like it's the environmental network swarm meeting up against this like material reality limitation on heat.
Well, you saw that little in COVID, right? So the environmentalists pushing for reducing fossil fuel use, you love COVID, love the restrictions on COVID because it lowered our carbon production globally. And so they're like, oh, wait a second, you know, let's not waste any crisis. Yeah. Let's take advantage of that to try to get the carbon levels into line. But that doesn't like support you as an individual. I mean, there's lots of things you can do as an individual. You know, I wrote for a while the Resilient Community letter, Home Free America, that kind of thing is like focused on, you know, how do you make your home a productive asset? You know, how do you use it to protect you? And as things become disrupted, as we see more and more disruptions, I mean, the sign that we're going to see a lot more of them is that we're starting to see, you know, things breaking and people can't even attribute a source to it because they don't understand how it plays, you know, what the motivation for that disruption will be and who did it.
Yes.
So, and it's like this many versus many conflict, you know, you'll just see these things pop up and people are like opportunistically breaking things and down, down, down. But as an individual or as an individual family, my strategy was, you don't want to totally disconnect and go off the grid and try to do everything yourself. It's just too time consuming. You'll spend all your time doing basic stuff. It's too expensive. What you do want to do is make your home productive enough or take measures in your life to be productive enough that when you face disconnection, you can flexibly turn from one thing to another and replace it, right? For the duration of the disruption. So have like multiple energy sources for your home heating and power production, right? Yeah. That, you know, add a pellet stove like I have burning behind me, you know, that complements the gas and which complements, I have a gas fired generator, whole house that protects me against power outages, which happen to be more frequent now. And I think they're twice as frequent in the U.S. now as they were 5 years ago, mm-hmm. while U.S. power production is flat, right? Because of environmental restrictions as we're taking nukes offline.
Yeah.
And so as you fill up the system, it becomes more prone to, or fill it, you know, as you put demand stress on the system, it becomes more prone to blackouts. So, and like with food production, it's not about producing all the food that you eat. It's gaining the knowledge necessary to actually produce some food. That means like going through the training, you know, doing the work to actually demonstrate to yourself and your family that you can produce some, and that you do some modifications to your land in terms of adding a garden that could add extras to your diet, right? It's a supplement. Give you green when there's not fresh produce available, maybe some staples that could squeeze out if there is a hardcore shortage. So it's that knowledge, that's that confidence that comes from having that. And you know, you don't want to be in a position where you have to do all your food production and all your energy production and everything off grid, because it's a quick road to spending all your day, just like somebody 200 years ago, you know, just producing enough to eat and heat yourself before you fall asleep, you know, bone tired.
Yes. Yes. Brian, did you have something you want to add? Cause this is basically, I have a lot to say on this point.
I think that the act of growing a single tomato, if the whole world, really everyone in America, would just grow a single tomato and then eat that tomato and notice how full or not full they were after eating a single tomato, they would get their mind changed around the idea that you can't just grow a garden to feed yourself. It doesn't exist. That you need a huge garden, and also spending all your time with you and all your kids to not starve. So I like the whole, if everybody would just grow one thing, we grow bees, we give friends honey. Can't survive on that, but our friends have honey. Another friend is an actual farmer, and so we get pigs and chickens from her, but she's actually a farmer with mm-hmm. land. So we have a combination of the friends who, you know, I made some apple butter, and the friend who's like, how many hogs do you want to buy this year?
Yes. So I love this. And I love this, the idea of the Dunbar number, the, you know, just, I think, so a lot of the people in Doomer Optimism, I said there was one type of environmentalist, and it's this like, you know, top down, we're going to do solar panels on everything and we're just going to run the system as usual. But we're just going to, you know, I guess, turn it all into electrified and cover the whole earth with all these renewables. I'm pro renewable, but I also think there needs to be like a simultaneous just shifting of entire lifestyle patterns so that we can manage what I think will be I wonder whether or not you agree with this, John, that there is like there is peak oil, that there is some peak in fossil fuels. I don't know whether or not you think that, but like that's basically a lot of our operating assumption. Like either some of us think, you know, maybe the peak is coming later on, maybe I know the technology is like quite advanced for
I'm not everything. Yeah, not so worried about the idea that we won't have enough, you know, oil available and fossil fuels. I think we're putting restrictions on that faster than we're running out of it, right? I think that, I mean, the ultimate kind of really super high level macro kind of frame for this is this thermodynamic trap that I was working on, is that, you know, human civilization is a thermodynamic system. It's a dissipative system. If you look up Prigogine and got his Nobel Prize for this, is that we have to consume a huge amount of resources, both cheap energy like fossil fuels or physical resources like nickel and lithium and things like that, in order to keep our complexity level of our society very high. But yes, the consequence of that, you know, consumption is that we produce entropy. Okay. And that was okay while we were, our civilization was smaller than the Earth's dissipative system. You know, mm-hmm. Earth is a dissipative system, but it's a lot more efficient than we are. And it kind of absorbed our excesses. Our civilization was an open system, allowed us to throw that entropy into the Earth, and the Earth would take care of it, kind of chew it up over time and disappear it. But all of a sudden we hit global level, right? And now we are as big as the Earth. and the ability of the Earth, maybe even one complete system, and there's no exterior for our entropy. And we're saying, okay, well, let's reduce our dependence on that cheap energy in order to reduce our entropy production. And we're going to replace that with a increased rate of dissipation of materials to build all these renewable things. I mean, like build the solar cells and build the electrical infrastructure and build the batteries. You know, we're suddenly chewing up physical resources at a massive rate.
Yeah.
Which of course isn't sustainable either. And it looked at it thermodynamically is that we are in a trap and there's no way to reduce our energy input enough to come up with a sustainable level of entropy reduction. The Earth is still going to constantly fight against us. And if we reduce our energy and resource levels coming into us too much, our whole system will fall apart because there's an arrow of time in dissipative systems. You got to keep on going forward. So the solution is to become an open system again, is to go to up and out to space. And it sounds crazy, but it's really quite, how fast we've built out the internet, what Musk has already done in terms of launch costs, building a global internet infrastructure in a handful of years, going out to space-based solar and space-based energy acquisition as a whole. You could put 30 surface areas of the Earth within the geosynchronous orbit of the Earth. I mean, in terms of solar energy production, you could put all our computing infrastructure up there. You could put all our manufacturing up there. You could have all the resources you need. Some of these asteroids that we just hit the other day, they're not out of reach. You know, the asteroid defense system that they just tested, they hit an asteroid like 14 million miles away. It's like, okay, we can get there.
Yeah.
Right. And some of these asteroids are worth $24 quadrillion in resources.
Right.
More resources than we have available at ease and inside the Earth without having to destroy the Earth to get them, having to blanket the Earth with renewable systems and deplete the Earth of everything it has. We could do it all there. Imagine taking all the cloud infrastructure and putting it right next to the solar production.
Yeah.
Like that's 20% of the world's energy, power use is now up there. So you export the entropy, export the stuff that, and expand and continue to move forward. So we could focus on living better down here without, falling into this trap. I think this is like a fundamental thing also on a psychological level, is if we don't have an upward vector or a forward vector, we start to turn in on ourselves. Mm. We start to, navel gaze and start to go into divisions and try to force everybody into compliance. Everyone has to think the same way, and anyone who doesn't is intrinsically evil. So I think that's the pathway to death and destruction, and let alone the thermodynamic pressures that are going to eventually squeeze that to death.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm agnostic about this vision. I'm open to it. Also think you make a really good point about having to have something that you're moving toward, like this moonshot idea where you're like our society is working towards something. But I also think that there is just having gone through this, and this is I think non-trivial. There is a forward moving psychological experience from decomplexifying your life. And so, but by that I mean, learning how to grow food in a simple sense, but like simplifying in general. I wonder whether or not you think there could be a simultaneous process and decomplexifying my life in some ways, and a lot of us are doing this, has helped me like almost get more in touch with my humanity, if that makes sense. I'm around my kids more. I'm in touch with nature more. I'm interacting with nature, but by nature, I mean like my chickens and my fruit trees and this kind of system. And then I'm also simultaneously, for example, I live in Uruguay. We have a 100% renewable grid. electricity grid. So then simultaneously, I'm able to enjoy the fruits of, like, you know, technological society by having reliable access to electricity, you know, the internet. The whole of Uruguay is, they're putting in fiber optic in the whole infrastructure in the whole country. So I like this barbell strategy, like, you know, thinking, can we simultaneously, and it isn't necessarily just lower energy use, it's like decomplexify to the sense that we're not, I think a lot of us on an individual level are like almost turning into automatons or like going into the metaverse in a way that really takes away our humanity. I don't know if you share that.
I agree. I mean, at an infrastructure level, if you have electricity coming from external sources that is too cheap to meter, and you like it's just beamed down, and you have unlimited resources, and all of the pollution and entropy associated with that is all gone. It's above, it's outside in this huge system that's vast and much larger than what we're at. It allows you to focus on the stuff here to make it more habitable and better, and you know, focusing on creating, you know, finding more meaning at an individual level. And you know, that decomplexifying, the simplification of life to focus on what matters, like, you know, family and you know,
time and nature, or
you time know, and nature and everything, you know, correct. And the problem is, if you know, the society is going exactly the opposite. We're going towards this AR, VR world and diving into this, once that hits, I mean, next year is going to be the first year of the augmented reality, where you add a digital overlay to everything. And it's like 2007 in smartphones, right? 2007 to 2022, you know, went from 0 to 6 billion people. So imagine this right now, 2023 to 15 years from now, 2038, it's going to be 6 billion people using AR to mitigate their perception of reality, where everything is overlaid, everything is modified by digital technology. In some ways, it could improve, like, correct your hearing, correct your vision, but it's like a complete departure and drill down on this thing that's going to be controlled by corporations and controlled by governments and controlled by the swarm. Saying you should only see reality this way. Ugh, and going exactly the opposite way.
Is that scary to you?
Oh yeah, no. That's why I think, you know, this is what McLuhan would say. We have, in order to stay alive and not kill each other, we have to, you know, build an artifact, technology artifact that encompasses all of the techno, you know, the socioeconomic system. But the assumptions that go into that, building that, whether it's like allows you a lot of individual autonomy to figure out how you're going to use it, right? Versus like a maximal stack that's kind of enforcing things on you, is
don't
being
you
fought
think
right now.
So much more likely, the latter is so much more likely. Just, I mean,
oh, yeah.
I'm just thinking about, like, I have colleagues who are environmentalists, academics and policymakers, and they work under the assumption that, like, basically, I call them the professional managerial class, not my term, but they basically work under the assumption, like, we know better than everybody else. Right. And so we need to impose limits, and those limits need to be, and a lot of times those limits, what they describe or what they come up with as the limits, are anti-ecological. You know, for example, there's a something called climate smart agriculture that's going on with the Gates Foundation in Africa, and it's like they're kicking people who know how to do pretty well-proven ecological, agroecological systems in Africa, smallholders who couldn't produce enough in the name of climate smart agriculture, which is just like drones and industrial ag, basically. And the yields are not increasing, but it's climate smart, so therefore it must be better. And now we have all these people in cities and like machines running the farms. And I just think, like, yeah, I mean, I think they basically think they know better. And if we're going to go in that direction, like, that's pretty scary. I wonder if there's like a way to secede from that.
Can I be optimistic here?
Yeah, please.
Is that allowed on this podcast?
Yes, of course.
More than ever, we have the ability to shut out the outside world and participate in small groups with a couple dozen people whose opinions we respect.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, there was three news channels. There were like five channels total on the television where you manipulate the little antenna things to get the fuzzy picture to go right. Or you'd go walk into the grocery store and go rent a VHS, of which there was a finite number.
Yes.
We're now in a world where we can resonate with the ideas that we hold, and we can ignore the fact that everyone else thinks we're crazy to a significant extent. Now, John's talking about at the network level banning some things like raised beds in front yards of HOAs. But as long as we can stay this side of that, we can actually increase the idea that, wait, you don't raise chickens? Are you feeling okay? Do we need to come check on you? What's wrong with you?
Yes.
And that concept, recently a friend brought over dinner, and the dinner was with ham from another friend's pigs, because we buy our pigs from one of my wife's best friends that is one peninsula over from us. Our food miles for that pig, and she gets it butchered on a butcher on her peninsula. The food miles for that pig is like 20 miles total.
Yeah.
And that's now like, that's cool. Let's just call it cool.
Yeah.
And the people who don't think about that are uncool, as far as I'm concerned. And I can go increase that vibe within everybody. Are you familiar with Modern T-Man, Ashley?
Yes. Yes. Yep.
Yeah. So he's a buddy of mine. That idea of that being cool, that it's cool that you know your farmer's name or your butcher's name or both, or making it cool. We raise bees. I'm a beekeeper. It's just sort of this casual thing I do. We don't sell our honey. We only have two hives. We lost both our hives last year because beekeeping is horrible and everything dies. But we're changing what it means to be cool. You don't have beehives? I'm so sorry for your loss. What happened to you? Are you okay?
So using the network swarm in this direction, I wonder, John, like, what do you see in terms of agency, possibility, you know, degrees of freedom here in between these different systems?
Brian nailed it, is that as long as we can continue to have the network available for these small groups to form, and, you know, for, I call it the descent, right? It's like all this, like, from good thinking to crazy thinking, as long as it's not like imminently dangerous where somebody's going to come stab you kind of thing, we're going to be okay. But the danger from the swarm, and you know what I'm talking about at this ascent, is not, you know, enforced, it's like opt-in, right? The danger from the swarm is that it will ban that, and it will get into the AR stuff and say, and get into the social networking at the network level and say, you're not allowed to think that. You're not allowed to interact like that. You're not even allowed to have conversations about that. And that the number of things that you're not allowed to do grows exponentially. And the ability of the network already at this early date to kind of control what you see, what you do, what you say, what you is getting easier and easier and more scalable. I mean, we already have social AIs. And when I say AI, I don't mean like a human equivalent. I mean something that lives off the data in between us and doesn't think like a human, that can moderate and intercede in the conversations of a billion people in real time, or billions of people in real time. And that's like a, you know, totalitarian's kind of wet dream from 20, 30 years ago. It's that there's no need for like a you know, massive bureaucracy to implement this. This is done on hardware that just is getting better and more capable of doing this every day. So that's what we got to prevent in order to allow all these great ideas at the periphery in the kind of descent world to continue.
Yeah.
You know,
and how much control do you think, do you think that there is the possibility of a global digital currency? And do you think there will be like, you're pretty good at predicting these kinds of things, like so some kind of social credit score system. How much do we have to just prevent those kinds of things from happening wholesale? Or is there a possibility of seceding or dissenting or being on the margins of the periphery? And let me just say for background, like I live in Uruguay for a reason. I'm kind of like I learned about world systems theory, which is Emmanuel Wallerstein, and you know, talking about there's like the core and the periphery nations, and the periphery, you know, they just aren't going to be in the center of like the global hegemonic powers are just not going to care that much about the periphery unless they have like
that's
resources
over.
They want
That's over with the network
Yeah, that so that's my question. Yeah, so, is it you know, over? Like, a lot is of there this, a way to escape? Yeah.
You know, if it, a lot of this stuff, like a social credit system that we're seeing in China, is already here. I mean, it's a de facto system. So it's kind of like done on the side. So there isn't any kind of formal thing saying that this hasn't been, you know, this shouldn't be talked about or these people shouldn't be online. It just happens in the background. The government doesn't mandate it, kind of hints. And the corporations kind of take care of it. And once one big corporation does it, all the others copy it. It's like a, you know, a normalization of social credit. We already have it. It's here. It's being implemented. And also you see it on the back door with the ESG stuff in the corporate space and how that's morphing and metastasizing into this big sprawling morass of, you know, God knows what. You know, coming from this, you know, being dictated by the swarm and influencing corporate behavior and influencing, you know, everything. You know, you're seeing it show up in how the digital currency should operate. And if there's a digital currency, you can put controls on it. And, or I just saw recently an open source project saying, you know, we're not, you know, the Stable Diffusion, which did the little AI creative stuff that people are playing with, it said, oh, we're open source, but we're democratic open source. Meaning the term democracy is now been kind of reworked and into something saying that if anyone in our community objects to how it could potentially be used, we'll dumb it down and put restrictions on it. We hear every voice. Mm. That's not how democracy works in any system. It's like the majority want, and it's not freedom in any way. It's like, it's not open source in any way, shape or form. It's like, you give me the code and I'll figure out how to use it in my best interest. Not you, you know, dumbing it down to this like, you know, neutered core that can barely do anything because, you know, you want to cater to all these different networks, putting pressure on you. So yeah, no, it's insidious. It's, and it's not just here. It's global. I mean, you can't get through modern life. And you can't work in the for a large, you know, to increasing degree, not just here, but everywhere, unless you're online into this, you know, dealing with this system. Here, you got to, you know, to date, a lot of times you have to be online or to, you know, to you know, do anything at work, you have to be emailing and you know, in the system. It's just being disconnected from it isn't really an option. And those restrictions are going in. Go ahead, Brent.
How familiar are you with Urbit?
Pretty much. Yeah.
Great. So I'm a failed Urbit user. I'm attempting to go get my planet actually operational because my friend Jonathan Pritchard is helping me because I'm, you know, a neophyte here. But Ashley, in brief, Urbit is a crypto powered operating system for everything. Whereas some people are now, they have machines that are now being custom built as Urbit machines. They don't run Windows. They don't run Apple. They're just Urbit. And they are building apps that can go both trade cryptocurrency, but also message each other. It's a new platform where there's something like 21 million stars or whatever it is, or some or planets. There's a finite number, so things can have value. And once you have your particular name there, it's yours forever, unless you sell it or lose it or whatever. But we're entering into a world where, and it, maybe it's not Urbit, maybe it's something like Urbit, where there could be a feature where, yeah, we're just going to say, nice, Microsoft, Google, whatever, you're doing your thing over here. We're going to have a completely different operating system. And right now it's at the serious geek level. I'm like this much of a geek and I'm struggling, but I'm also trying to deploy it not on the command line. I'm trying to use a desktop browser, which, you know, because I'm.
Yes. Okay. So wait, let me just briefly say something before John jumps in. So just 2 days ago, somebody made me an Urbit planet. And I just started looking at it. It's not super operational as far as I can tell, but probably if I got into it more, it could be. But I believe this is like Curtis Yarvin is somewhat involved in this project. And I've heard somebody, I just read a, I think it was Compact Magazine piece. They had, Urbit had a conference recently, I believe.
Yeah, the assembly, yeah.
And my the person who was writing up a description of what happened at that conference described Urbit as like digital homestead.
Cyberpunk.
And I thought this was really interesting because I went to the National Conservatism Conference, and I heard a lot of people talking about some version of Jeffersonianism, more localism, connection to place, connection to community, in these various ways. Not necessarily agrarian, but just like a more localized manufacturing. And it was super interesting to me that a lot of people are pulling on this thread. It's a real history we have and legacy we have of like a Jeffersonian approach to, our country and our world. And I thought it was really interesting to think about that in the context of Urbit, which is like, maybe it's place-based, maybe it's an alternative system. It's not just run by the globalists. It's not just run by the professional managerial class. It's decentralized. It's run by the people who use it, kind of thing. So I'm wondering if that any of that resonates with you, John.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea that there is like a fallback, right? There's like this last-ditch kind of way of connecting when everything else kind of fails. And we see that, if you try to find alternative hosting systems or try to set up alternative to the big systems, you're not going to be able to do that if they turn against you. I mean, how quickly they turned off Parler and all these others and shut them down, and they could shut them down again. They're not immune. They're very vulnerable. It's not easy to kind of scale up and reach a kind of a critical mass using the traditional approach. It also means that you're not on the systems that are making the decisions. You're not out there doing battle, dissent versus swarm, dissent versus consensus or this emerging consensus, which is going to decide the direction of everything, right? It also gives you reach and connectivity to billions of people, people that you didn't even know existed. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to be said for going out there and being part of that mix. Mm-hmm. I think systems like Urbit is good to be, knowledgeable of, maybe participating in, and knowing that it exists and knowing and supporting the community, because it is a fallback. Like it gives you options, right? Yes. Again, like everything else, that's not to say that it's totally immune from being disconnected. It can be. Then you'd have to start working on systems or contributing to systems for like a mesh network that would replace it, the traditional network.
Right.
That would, in order to stay connected. But, and it's the kind of system that would zoom the moment a big crackdown, the moment the long night becomes inevitable.
Yes.
And then you that's when all of a sudden the activity in that space just goes to the moon.
Yes.
And it, as one of the earlier players, then you get all this traction and help from people or connection to people as they try to scramble to find a way to get onto the system with you.
Yep. I really like that. And it brings me back to what we were talking about earlier, where I just generally think it's smart to not be agnostic and toward a lot of these emergent strategies, and to almost have like a barbell strategy where it's like you can both have a foot in the actual digital world as it's constituted now, and keep your mind open to something like Urbit. You can be open to mining and manufacturing and energy production out in space, but also lowering your total energy consumption or shifting it. Like you can do what we do for heating in the winter is we thin out our little wood lot in a sustainable manner, in a way that it's still it's basically just it's not extractive. So we can do energy in a way that's like in ecological balance, while also like getting energy, in this super high tech way. And I think, I generally think the barbell strategy being agnostic is the right way. I think that there are just not a lot of people like us who don't just fall into some ideological trap and then, want to pick one thing and make it their thing and not be open-minded to the rest. And so I wonder if there's like a closing message, basically, almost like an appeal for your own security to keep an open mind and to all of the above strategies that we're discussing today.
Can I go first, John?
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's my closing appeal. You might be wrong. And you might be wrong about that which you hold most dear and that you're most sure of, not just wrong about the thing you don't care about, but the thing you're most sure of. If you think back to the year 2000 and your perceptions about the world and what you knew to be true, and then you compare it to what's now true in 2022, what you know to be true now, unless you're, I don't know, John Robb, you like, wow, I was wrong about some fundamental perspectives. That's fascinating. And so being around other people who are willing to change their minds, which is to say willing to eschew tribalism and all the warm fuzzies that it brings, is critical, because likely in 2042, you'll look back to 2022 and go, I was wrong about some fundamental things. And if you're only with people who are who hold tribalism above all else, that's going to be a problem. It's going to make it much harder for you to understand if you're wrong and how you're wrong. Mm-hmm.
John, last word, appeal.
Can you still hear me? Yes, I hit my microphone. Okay, yes, good. Yes. I was kind of filter out the border collies. Stay fundamentally optimistic. We'll muddle through. I kind of have a belief in this timeline that it's not going to end in, total disaster or the extinction of us. You just want to be cognizant of what's going on in the global level, participate in that kind of struggle and where you think it's important, and then mitigating the effects of the negative effects of what happens at the global level to you personally, and focusing on the things that matter at the personal level that gives you the peace of mind to keep going forward every day, right? To be happy, to enjoy life, and wherever whatever source that you draw from in order to make that happen. But this is a turbulent time, right? And it's best not to think the world is falling and there's you're about to be squashed all the time. It's no benefit in that. It's just taking measures to mitigate any negative effects. Mm-hmm. And don't let other people tell you how to be happy, right? Don't let that tribe dictate to you what you should be fearful of, and determine it yourself.
Yep.
Think for yourself.
Yeah, I love that. That's like that could be the doomer optimism theme. Just the last couple minutes of you speaking. That's exactly what we're all about. Try to keep an open mind, be adaptive to information as it's coming in, be clear-headed about what information is coming in, and not just by the party line, be skeptical, but also make meaning in your life in the way that you can be, and be prepared for whatever you see coming. But don't get, I think a lot of people are really nihilistic and totally overcome by doom. You can't get stuck there. I understand it, but you've got to move past it. That's what this podcast is all about, finding ways to move past that. So John, this is so great. Thank you so much. You're such an amazing expert. Thank you, Brian, for setting this up. This was so lovely. I'm so grateful you came on.
Thanks, Ash.
All right. Have a good one, everybody.
Thanks, Brian. Bye-bye.
Bye.